Can you tell us what is the Calaveras Ranger District? How does it fit with the Forest Service structure, and what do you do in it?
Well, thanks, Steve. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with your listeners and kind of and share what we're doing at the Calaveras Ranger District. So the Calaveras Ranger District, the area, it includes a land area that's about 200,000 acres. It goes from the crest of the Sierra west to about the 3,500-foot elevation, and our northern boundary is the McCollumy River, and the southern boundary is the Middle Fork of the Stan. So I have a staff of about 25 to 30 permanent employees, and during the summer when we hire our temps, we swell to about 50 people, and with that group, we manage the 200,000 acres of land. The Calaveras Ranger District is one of four ranger districts on the Stanislaus National Forest, and so we're the northernmost district. The forest goes all the way as far south as the Merced River, the Calaveras or the Stanislaus National Forest is part of a system of national forests in the state of California. We're in the Pacific Southwest region. There's 18 national forests in the region. And so I'm privileged to manage one of the district units in that area.
Not long ago, this type of a job in management of a forest seemed to be filled predominantly by people of the male persuasion. How did you get to be a district ranger, rise to that level, and what's it been like? Are you a pioneer?
Well, I think there's some women a little bit ahead of me who are really the pioneers, but when I started in this agency in 1979, I was one of a few, very few women in a professional series. I started out as a landscape architect and got a degree, bachelor's degree in landscape architecture, and so my world was filled with working with a lot of men in the field and in the office. But the agency probably 25 years ago started making some concerted efforts to promote women into positions of higher leadership in the agency, to the point where we are today, where I think that probably about 50% of the higher leadership positions in the agency are women. And on the Stanislaus National Forest, actually about 3 years ago, as recently as 3 years ago, all of our six line officer positions on the forest were women. So now it's kind of more balanced, about half and half.
It turns out our generation of men is the last one not to get away with it. But our first one not to get away with it. Anyway, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the what does a district do? What are the roles? What's the responsibilities under your direction? What activities do you carry out?
Well, everything that's involved with managing that piece of national forest ground, and the national forests have a mandate, a mission of multiple use, as opposed to the national parks, which have a mission for preservation. So we have a lot of activities going on in the district, including fuel reduction work, timber sales, grazing, recreation use, special events, recreation residences that are on lease, a whole host of recreational uses, plus wise use of our natural resources.
A lot to balance. I guess we'll get into that a little later in the discussion.
Definitely.
You've been instrumental, actually, another kind of a pioneer in trying to develop a new relationship between Forest Service and the communities that are forested. In this area, you were one of the founding members, I believe, of the Amador-Calaveras Consensus Group. What's that, and what's the Forest Service interest in such collaboratives?
Yeah, well, the Amador-Calaveras Consensus Group is a really exciting, probably the most rewarding part of my job. And I was involved at the ground level with that. We were actually invited to participate. And I think that the strength of Amador-Calaveras Consensus Group is the fact that it is a grassroots. It's an organization formed by the people in this area and not by the federal government, which is its strength. And so as an agency, Amador-Calaveras, well, as a collaborative group, Amador-Calaveras was one of the first in this region that was interested in Forest Service management. And so Amador-Calaveras Consensus Group really led the way to pave the way for new collaborative groups across the state of California to form to work with the Forest Service in managing these public lands. And the agency has really stepped forward and endorsed this model for managing the national forests in a way that's not only sustainable and preserves the resources for future generations, but helps to really support our local communities and make sure that not only are the forests healthy, but the communities are healthy that help support them.
This was once an area, the Central Sierra, that was subject to a great deal of litigation about Forest Service practices, silviculture methods, what parts of the forest would be preserved, what might be part of economic development. Seemed to be a very litigious area. Has the collaborative changed any of that, and if so, why?
Oh, definitely. You know, I think that the Forest Service, it was a major shift in culture for the agency to open up and let the local community speak about their wishes about land management, and it's made our decisions better decisions that are more well balanced with the needs of the public and the needs of the resources we're protecting. We involve the public, in particular the Amador-Calaveras Consensus Group, very early on in our project planning. We've spent a lot of time working with members of the group, taking them out on field trips, discussing specific treatments on the land, exactly where the treatments are to take place. And, you know, we've discussed, you know, if we remove this many trees of this size, what's it going to do to the wildlife habitat? And we kind of hash through those issues with the scientists present, as well as the community members, to provide both viewpoints. And I think that's resulted in both Forest Service employees and the community members being more aware, more educated about the other the other side's position. And I don't mean to characterize them as different sides, because I think we're all in this together. We all have a common goal of protecting these resources for the common good.
Well said, and in fact, it seems that that attitude has taken root so well that the ACCG, the Amador Calaveras Consensus Group, was awarded, along with the Forest Service of both El Dorado and Stanislaus, a Collaborative Forest Landscape Restoration Act Award. Highly competitive, only a few in the country. What is that about, and what does that mean for the future of these forests?
Yeah, that was a wonderful accomplishment. So in 2009, along with the Farm Bill of that year, Congress authorized the Collaborative Forest Landscape Restoration Program. And in 2011, Amador Calaveras Consensus Group put together a proposal to identify over 390,000 acres of land within the Amador Ranger District on the El Dorado and the Calaveras Ranger District on the Stanislaus National Forest. And this is for the purpose of doing a large-scale landscape restoration project in that land area. Part of the program required that we do collaboration with the local community, and I think this project was called, or is called, Cornerstone, and the strength of it is that we are looking for these triple bottom line benefits, which is to the local ecosystem, the local economy, and the social structure of the local community. And so we were successful in competing nationwide for that project. In 2012, we were awarded the Cornerstone Collaborative Forest Landscape Restoration Project. It's one of 23 in the country. It's a 10-year program. So we started in 2012. We're just about halfway through. And this project, throughout the 10 years, we requested about $1.7 million in funding. That's shared between the Amador District and the Calaveras District. And a key part of this program is that for every dollar of federal money that goes into it, we have to come up with an equal amount of matching funds. And some of those matching funds are other federal dollars, but a key part of that is contributions through grants and other sources that the community's been able to help us with. It also includes in-kind services provided by members of ACCG and others who help us with implementation of this project.
This is pretty big news when millions of dollars come into an area and utilized for that triple bottom line purpose. And so, of course, we always look to local benefit. How do you manage to, working with all of the federal requirements and all of the contracting issues that come with it, how do you get money once you're doing restoration in a local area? How does that money go to people in the local communities that are one of the intended beneficiaries of CFLRA funding?
Yeah, and unfortunately, that's proven to be a very difficult thing to accomplish. You know, being part of the federal government, we have some pretty strict, and we have federal laws surrounding our acquisitions and contracting procedures, and a lot of that relies on low bid to award contracts. We've been looking for other ways to get to award contracts to local people, recognizing that there's more benefit to the federal government other than just the price of the services we're acquiring, and that is the other economic benefit to the local community and maintaining our local infrastructure. So there's some different things and this is still a progress in the works. We haven't really cracked this nut yet, but I think we're getting closer. We're working at the regional level. We have folks in the regional office who are looking through all of the federal purchasing regulations and contracting regulations, trying to find ways for us to give preference to local contractors. And we do have means to do that, but we're still trying to figure out exactly how to make that work a little bit better. The other way that we've been able to get some of this money to local folks is, well, for one, our temp workforce that we hire to support the project, a substantial number of those have been local individuals. The other way is through agreements, and you know, we've set up a master participating agreement with the local CHIPS organization, and through that way we've been able to engage in a partnership with CHIPS to do some of the restoration projects on Cornerstone, and CHIPS is all about hiring the local workforce, so that's a real bonus for us. We're also in the process of looking at establishing another agreement, a master stewardship agreement, with the Upper Meokalmie River Watershed Authority, and we're expecting that we'll be getting that signed in about a month, and they are very interested in hiring local to get this work done. So under that model, the Upper Meokalmie River Watershed Authority would be contracting with local contractors directly to get the work done. We would be contributing some money towards that work through UMRA organization, and they are going to be contributing some money as well through grants that they're seeking out. So we're trying to go about this in a lot of different ways to get the money to stay local. Large stumbling blocks we've found is we do have means of hiring local through the Small Business Administration, different authorizations, and but we need local folks to get certified as 8A contractors or women-owned small businesses, minority-owned small businesses. Some of these special programs that the Small Business Administration offers would help us a great deal in being able to award locally.
I guess one of the questions that comes up is, why do these forests need restoration? It seems like a natural forest restores itself rather handily, and Mother Nature did that for millions of years. So what happened to our forests that make it necessary to restore them?
Well, us humans, you know how we think we can control the earth. We started tinkering, and now we've quite effectively kept fire out of these ecosystems. And fire was the primary disturbance agent in the Sierras that cleaned out the forest, that thinned out the trees, and kept the meadows and whatnot healthy. So we eliminate fire from the equation as we have encroaching private subdivisions coming closer and closer to the national forests. And there was no way that we could keep up with thinning the trees as fast as the fires would have done had they been allowed to continue to burn. So there we have the situation we're in, and then on top of that, you have long-term drought and then the bug kill that's come in the wake of that. So it's a perfect storm of terms there.
It seems we haven't been entirely successful at keeping fire suppressed in the forest. In fact, the recent Butte fire, although it didn't happen in the National Forest, and more particularly the Rim fire, which was a huge fire within the Stanislaus Forest, or included parts of the Stanislaus Forest, are we at higher risk because of our treatment or lack of stewardship in the last decades? What happened that makes us so burnable?
Yeah, definitely we're at higher risk, and it's because that those forests didn't get cleaned by routine fire. And I'm not a fire expert, but I believe our return interval in this part of the Sierras was something around 7 to 15 years for natural fire. So we interrupted that sequence, and and then you have drought situations and more people actually coming into the forest. You have more opportunities for somebody to accidentally start a fire. And so it has a lot of fuel built up that it can carry the fire, and it can be devastating, much more so than a natural fire would have been.
You had mentioned that the Upper McCollumay River Watershed Authority was in discussions and partnering up on a stewardship agreement. Why would a water-oriented agency have any interest in the restoration of forests?
Well, I'm pretty sure that East Bay Mud is seeing that right now after the Butte Fire, with all of the sedimentation that's ending up in Pardee Reservoir. So the Upper McCollumay River Watershed Authority is very much aware that their water ultimately starts on the national forests, and that in order to maintain quantities of water and water quality that they're looking for, we need to make sure our forests are healthy. So that's, you know, restoring our meadows to bring them back to functionality, to be the sponges that they should be, to absorb the snowmelt and then release the water slowly downstream throughout the summer.
Well, how does a meadow fail? Why would we need to restore meadows, and what does that have to do with water supply?
Well, we've had, because again of the removal of fire, natural fire from the equation, we've had conifers encroaching on those meadows from the perimeters. In some cases, the conifers have totally overcome the meadow, so you can't see there's a meadow there anymore. Those conifer trees are sucking up the water that would be staying in the soil in the meadow. And so, like I said, a meadow is very much like a sponge, and the water gets absorbed as the snow melts, and then it releases slowly throughout the summer. So it's a more consistent flow of water. A lot of our meadows have, not only do they have the encroaching conifers, but then the streams that run through them, instead of fanning out and distributing water across the meadow, they've managed to work themselves into gullies and channels. And so that the water goes through the meadow faster, doesn't soak in, and ends up downstream a lot faster than we want it to.
We've talked a little bit about fire as a bad event, at least in its current iterations. I've heard talk of actually putting fire back on the landscape. Miwok people did that in mosaic burns through the forest for 10,000 years at least around here, apparently to good effect. Is there any possibility that the Forest Service will be, and this is part of your plans, to put fire back on the landscape in a safe and timely way?
Yeah, definitely. That is our goal. And we've been working on that for probably at least 10 years. This spring, we're going to be doing a prescribed burn in the Arnold area. We're hoping to burn about 150 acres behind those homes there in Arnold.
That should be pretty exciting to them.
Yeah.
In a variety of ways, I imagine.
We've done some of those burns in the past. The trouble is, because of it is so close to residential areas, it's highly sensitive, and we have to make sure that we have burn conditions, weather conditions, and whatnot that assure that we can, you know, keep the fire under control. We certainly don't want anything to escape control. But beyond that, we are including in our landscape restoration projects, and we just completed the environmental analysis for the Hemlock project, which is about 10,000 acres of land up Highway 4 in the Cabbage Patch area. There's prescribed burning in there that's already been approved through the NEPA process, the National Environmental Policy Act. And so our intent is to, after we do go in and do the manual thinning of vegetation, is to follow up then in successive years with prescribed burning to help maintain the openness of those stands.
So you actually have to do work to thin it out before you can reintroduce fire, because otherwise we'd just light the whole place up and be doing our own version of the rim fire.
Yep, exactly.
Boy, we got in a pretty deep hole.
Yeah.
One of the things that's come up over the last couple of years is the Richard Vilsack and Randy Moore, Richard Vilsack being the Secretary of Agriculture nationally, in charge of the Forest Service, among other things, and the and Randy Moore, who's the director or head of the Region 5, which includes your district. Both have said and remarked repeatedly in both leadership intent documents, but also in their presentations to the public, that we are at such a slow pace and scale, given the litigation, given the history, and given how far behind the eight ball we got on these things, that we would have to increase pace and scale of restoration activities exponentially to be able to even keep up with the growth of our forests in relation to the fire suppression issues that you've already remarked upon. What are these leadership intents, and how do you increase pace and scale of this work to the point where we're doing this every 15 to 25 years rather than every 1,000?
Yeah, so Randy Moore is the regional forester for the California region, and he's actually elevated this increasing pace and scale of forest restoration or ecological restoration as a an emphasis. He's elevated that to the national level, and some of the other regions are now moving in that same direction. And he talks a lot about increasing the pace and scale. Well, you know, the Forest Service hasn't seen an increase in our budget in many, many years. It's been pretty consistent at a consistent level for the last several years. So we recognize there's additional work to do. We don't have enough money to do all the work that needs to be done. So we're making some concerted efforts to engage partners in helping us to do this work. And so part of that is, you know, is why we work with Amador Calaveras Consensus Group. They have some capacity to get grant money that we couldn't qualify for. The master stewardship agreement we're working on with the Upper Mokelumne River Watershed Authority is another way to help us increase the pace and scale. Again, they qualify for some grants that the federal government doesn't qualify for, and so we can work in partnership with them to actually get some larger scale treatments on the land than we would have funds to do. And you know, like I said earlier, this cornerstone project under the Collaborative Forest Landscape Restoration Program only pays for half of the treatments anyway. So we're really spending a lot more of our efforts than we have in past years on seeking other sources of funding besides federal appropriated funds. And it's a constant struggle.
Richard Vilsack, Secretary Vilsack's leadership intent, talked about an all-lands theory. And we learned a lot about all-lands by the Butte Fire, which didn't seem to recognize the border between BLM lands and private lands, for instance, or the Rim Fire, which went through private lands, BLM lands, and burned all the way up to Granite through U.S. Forest Service lands. So if nature sees itself as one, the leadership intent said that we should too, that we should not be doing projects based on boundaries that are artificial, but more landscape-based. What does that mean? What are we talking about there? And how do you go about, with all these siloed budgets and all these siloed staffs and all these ways that people have worked differently in different agencies and in the private sector, how do you reconcile that into a common effort?
Yeah, that's tough. You know, the Collaborative Forest Landscape Restoration Act did talk about all lands, yet when the money came down, we were limited to only spending it on federal lands, and Forest Service at that, not even BLM. So, again, this is where we work with our partners to try and achieve the all lands approach, and it's very much what we're interested in because we've recognized for a long time that none of these natural forces, whether it's fire or insect infestation, drought, follow any sort of boundaries that are human-made. So, you know, we work with, for example, we work with CAL FIRE and SPI in trying to establish a network of fuel breaks across the landscape that is following topography lines rather than property lines. And we work very closely with or have the ability to work closer with BLM, which has some common boundaries with us. There's also been some efforts at the national level through the Good Neighbor Authority, which was authorized in the Farm Bill for 2015, Farm Bill. And recently, Randy Moore just signed an agreement with Mr. Laird at the Natural Resources Office of the state to allow some swapping of state resources with federal to allow the state to assist us in that all lands approach. And so we're looking for other tools to help us work across boundaries. It's difficult when you have these limits of keeping federal dollars on federal lands.
We're talking to Teresa McClung, district ranger for the Calaveras Ranger District of the Stanislaus National Forest. We're going to take a quick music break right now. We'll be back with her and ask her some questions about controversies and public issues in the Calaveras Ranger District.
Life is like a river that runs to eternity, and all must ride that river, honey, just like you and me. It's sometimes rough and muddy with rapids along the way. For some the trip is shorter, but all must have their day. There's no dark and rolling tide between you and me. Lots of love and happiness far as I can see. There's a dark and muddy current that can sweep your boat from sight. If you pass that point of no return, there's a dark and endless night. There's also a mighty boatman, and he's out there every day. Just put your life in his hands and you're safely on your way. There's no dark and rolling tide between you and me. Lots of love and happiness far as I can see. Raging river when the banks were caving in, when the storms have almost beaten us, we've always tried again. Let's keep the faith together, encouraging our friends, until we reach that crystal sea of life that never ends. There's no dark and rolling tide between you and me. Lots of love and happiness far as I can see.
We've been talking to Teresa McClung from the Calaveras Ranger District. She's the district ranger in charge of the whole operation. And we've been talking about a number of areas of consensus and agreement. We're going to turn for a moment to some things that haven't quite been entirely resolved and are typical controversies for a a ranger district and the Forest Service in general. I'll start with one of your favorites, I'm sure. There's been quite a controversy in your district regarding what's become known as the Candy Rock Shooting Range. What's going on there? What are the problems? What are the issues and controversies that you have to adjudicate on that?
Yeah, so that's been a pretty challenging problem to resolve with the community. Candy Rock, there's a quarry there called the Candy Rock Quarry that's been there since 1950s, and in fact they did mine a particular stone called Candy Rock out of there, which ended up getting used, I understand, in some fireplaces in some of the older homes in the area. And people started shooting, doing target practice there at that time, and have been using it ever since. Now, target shooting is a legal activity in the national forests. On the Stanislaus, we don't have any designated shooting ranges, and shooting is allowed anywhere that it's safe. And there's specific federal regulations that define what safe shooting is, that include things like don't shoot across roads or water bodies, and don't shoot in occupied areas. No, don't shoot in campgrounds, things like that. It's mostly common sense. So people have been target shooting here, you know, for 50 years or more. And meanwhile, the development in the area has consistently increased, and more people have moved in closer to the National Forest, and in this case closer to the quarry and where the shooting is. So when I first became district ranger in 2008, I started getting phone calls from neighbors who were complaining about the noise of the shooting, worried about whether it was safe or not, whether there might have errant bullets in their neighborhood, and that sort of thing. And at the time, we explained to folks that, yes, this was a legal activity, because some people think that it's not. It certainly must be illegal, which isn't true. And then Marita Calloway was the county supervisor at the time, and she stepped forward to help us resolve the issue with the community. And so she helped us get together some of the neighbors who were concerned, as well as some of the folks who use the shooting area regularly, to try and identify some solutions to the problems. Some of the things that we talked about at the time was increasing signage, so that when people did go there to shoot, they understood where the residences are in relation to where the open national forest is, because a lot of those houses, you can't even see them. They're tucked in the trees. We talked about increasing our patrols in the area. We also brought the sheriff's department on board to help us out and increase patrols a little bit as well. We also put some berms on the perimeter to kind of further define the area and help to prevent an errant bullet from going towards the houses. So these efforts were implemented, and the neighbors in the area still weren't happy with the ongoing shooting, that it was disrupting their lifestyle and their enjoyment of their personal property. We after a few years of working with the community and hiring some contractors to come in and help us try and find some mutually agreeable solutions, we established shooting hours there as a kind of compromise position. So right now we have a forest order in place that limits shooting at the quarry to 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. weekdays. I believe it's 10 a.m., I'm sorry, it's 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. weekdays, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Saturdays, and no shooting on Sunday. And so this was to give the local residents some quiet time while still allowing the shooters to shoot there. So those shooting hours are in place. They've been in place for about 4 years now. The shooters are pretty happy with that. They, the ones that regularly use the area, do happily shoot within those hours and try to respect the local community's concerns. We do always have some folks who don't follow the rules, and some of them have been cited for that. However, there are some of the neighbors that are still not satisfied with that solution. So it's an ongoing challenge, and I don't know. We're going to be embarking on a forest plan revision for the Stanislaus National Forest probably starting next year, and so target shooting across the National Forest may be a subject that we look at, which would resolve or provide a solution to that that wouldn't just focus on Candy Rock. It would focus on a more broad forest-wide basis, because the concern is, one of the big concerns is, if we close the Candy Rock quarry to shooting, people will go elsewhere, and those elsewhere places are probably less safe. So I'd like to solve the problem and not the symptoms.
It's always interesting to see how these things develop. There's the question of who got there first, and what are the traditions of a place versus how many more people have moved in, and in a democracy, do those votes, does the majority rule? You speak of this in calm tones, but I believe some of the meetings leading to the agreements that you described, or the policy solutions you described, were anything but calm. I think it's much to your credit that you were able to stay level-headed through such a contentious issue.
Well, thank you.
This brings me to another contentious issue. The off-road vehicles use, both the limitations and entitlements for use of such, and snowmobiles, have become much discussed, not just in your forest, but all throughout California and the West, probably nationally, I would guess. What's going on that front?
Yeah, at the national level, we have a roads policy that requires us to designate routes for OHVs and pedestrian passenger vehicles across all the national forests. In the past, some forests more than others, people actually just drove cross country. Road or no. So that was identified several years ago as one of the major threats to the national forests in the country. So controlling off-road vehicle use has been a focus. We went through a lengthy process doing an environmental impact statement on the Stanislaus that ended in a decision in 2009 to implement a system of routes where motorized vehicles were allowed, and we have a motor vehicle use map that we hand out that gets modified every year that defines what routes people can be on with the motorized vehicles, and they can stop by the ranger station anytime and pick those up. They're free. As we mitigate some of the impacts of some of these roads, which had to do with maybe causing sedimentation into streams or other things like that. As we mitigate some of those impacts, we can add roads to the system. So that's why that map gets updated every year. So that was the travel management rule. It's considered part B. There's three parts to it. Part A is a minimization of routes rule, which the forest hasn't embarked on yet. Part C is winter motorized use, so it's snowmobiles, and we are in the middle of that right now. We're working on an environmental impact statement. This was a court-ordered project, and we have a settlement agreement that's dictating the timing on completing that, which should be late 2017, I believe. So we're working right now with the local community in identifying snowmobile routes on the Stanislaus National Forest and identifying areas that would be closed to snowmobiles for a more quiet recreation emphasis. And Highway 4 and Highway 108, snowmobiling is really popular on both routes. And so this is also, as you can imagine, a controversial subject because we have people who want to cross-country ski and snowshoe and do a quiet winter recreation in the same places where people want to be snowmobiling. And then on top of that, we have threatened endangered species and Yosemite toad, the Sierra Nevada yellow-legged frog, red-legged frog as well. These are new species that have been listed. They're in that high country. We don't have science that tells us how snowmobiling over the top of their habitat may affect them or not. And then we've also got Sierra Nevada red fox up in the high country as well. And we don't have science that tells us exactly how snowmobiling affects their life cycle.
In the end, do these decisions land on your desk?
No, actually, which is kind of a relief. So the forest supervisor is responsible for making those decisions. And on the Stanislaus National Forest, Jeannie Higgins is the forest supervisor. All of the tough ones she gets. Any decision regarding Candy Rock Quarry will be Jeannie's as well.
I would guess you have effective recommendation on occasion, however.
Oh, yeah. And my staff, so my knowledge of the local community and the local resources, along with the research that my staff has done on any issue, informs the forest supervisor, and she, makes the best decision that she can.
On another matter that has come with a lot of controversy over the years, you may recall you were in the Forest Service, I think you said 32 years.
Mm-hmm.
So you've seen the Sagebrush Rebellion, the Home Rule movement, and most recently up in Oregon at a wildlife refuge, an occupation of people that were angry with federal agencies and felt that local people needed to take control. Toward what end was not entirely clear up in Oregon, but you've certainly got the ambiance of the suspicion that many rural people have over federal control of lands. Some counties, Mono County, for instance, I believe, and Inyo have a majority of their land is under federal jurisdiction.
Alpine County as well.
Alpine as well. So when that happens, I imagine there are different tactics and strategies that people who have concerns about federal policy might use. What's your take on the Oregon situation? What is that a good way to relate to a federal agency? And if not, what are the alternatives?
Well, all I know about that situation is what I read in the paper. I think that through efforts, the local efforts that we've taken by, this intimate involvement with the Amador Calaveras Consensus Group, that I'm hoping that we could relieve any folks who have angst about federal management of federal lands. I really see this as a partnership with the local community, and I think that when you get a group of people together, whether they be feds or private individuals, they can start to see each other as, we're all people. We all live in this community. We reap the benefits of its resources, and we're in this together. We want the same things. We want these forests to be maintained for the public good in perpetuity, and we want them to be healthy, to provide all the resources like the precious water for the state of California. And we can't do that if we don't, know people by name and be able to look them in the eye and work through these hard issues together. And we've found with Amador Calaveras Consensus Group that when you develop these relationships with the community where you feel comfortable sharing your you know, personal triumphs and tragedies, and you can talk more honestly about your disagreements and respectfully disagree and work harder to come to solutions that are mutually benefit for all. So I would suspect that the relationships there weren't as strong as what we've got that we're working on here locally. But like I said, I don't have any firsthand knowledge of what was going on there.
I found it ironic that during that occupation up there, the ACCG was working on helping create a community forest out of 15,000 acres of Bureau of Land Management lands, which had been poorly, actually unmanaged because they were unfunded. But the idea of a community forest would be to build the resources in a collaborative way to manage this and have public and local community input and, in fact, control over what goes on there. Two very different approaches, and it seems one ended in death and tragedy and no policy change whatsoever, whereas the other creates 15,000 acres of a renewed community engagement and local control. Is the latter the harbinger of the future, or do you see the West as of mixed approach?
No, I would certainly hope that we could take this model of community forests with BLM and expand that to all federal lands so that the local folks have a feeling like they have control and a vested interest in the well-being of those public lands, and also so that they can feel like they're a part of that management in perpetuity for not only the benefit of the local area, but for the nation as a whole. And we're working, you know, in our work with the Upper McCallumee River Watershed Authority, and they would be the ones who BLM is working with on the community forest as well. And so with our master stewardship agreement, the terms are different, but the intent is the same. So we're really hoping that all of the lands within the Cornerstone Project, that 390,000 acres on Amador and Calaveras District, could be managed under that kind of a model through this master stewardship agreement.
That's music to the ears, I'm sure, of people in Willsieville, West Point, Glencoe, and Railroad Flat, surrounded by BLM lands that are quick to burn. We found that out the hard way when the fire, the Butte Fire, went up and over Highway 26 through BLM lands that had not had much restoration activity at all. And we learned that in the opposite way on the BLM lands in which the ACCG had actually, and CHIPS in particular, had done fire breaks, fuel reduction. The fire was stopped right at those breaks, and it allowed the thinning of the forest allowed fire crews to actually do 5,000-foot hose lays into the River Canyon, which is where ultimately the towns of West Point, Willsieville, Railroad, and Glencoe were saved. So it's clear what we do matters, and what we don't do matters as well.
Yes, definitely. And I would like to add just my sincere condolences to the victims of the Butte Fire. You know, it didn't come onto the National Forest, but we were evacuated as well, and I can't even imagine what the members of this community are going through. You know, it hit my staff. We had one employee who did lose a house. You know, these are the kinds of things that I think bring, unfortunate as they are, they bring the community closer together, and I see that working in small ways.
This leads to another question. We're talking about restoration in the national forests. Do the private lands in our area need to have an approach similar?
Yeah, it's a lot harder when you have multiple ownerships, but it would be wonderful if there was a concerted effort to do some vegetation treatments, removal of fuels across all lands and into the national forests. And we're also starting to take a look at the western boundary of the national forest, which has got a lot of checkerboard ownerships where we have federal parcels surrounded by private or surrounded by BLM. Some of them we don't even know if we have access to, but we're starting to take a look at that to see how we can develop some vegetation management plan for that. And we're looking at that through this Cornerstone program. But the planning is probably 3 years out for getting anything implemented in that area.
Well, we're beginning to run out of time, but I've got a couple more questions for you.
Sure.
Tree mortality. We notice in the non-burned areas of Calaveras that many trees are dying. Ponderosa pines, Doug firs, massive die-off. And I understand south of us, down in the San Bernardino Forest, that as much as 75% of the of parts of that forest have died. What's going on here, and does that factor into your future planning?
Well, yeah, so I don't have exact numbers, but on the Sequoia and the Sierra National Forests, they're experiencing 70 to 80% mortality due to beetle infestation. Some of it is just drought related, but some of it is beetles as well. The beetles move in when you have drought stress trees. That is moving north and moving higher in elevation, so we're starting to see it in the Highway 108 corridor and a little bit on Highway 4. And so the region is involved with the state, the governor's task force on tree mortality. We'll be looking at, on the Calaveras District, we'll be looking at removing hazard trees from roadsides, high hazard areas basically, roadsides, campgrounds, facilities, property lines, that sort of thing. And then the big dilemma is once you put down a tree, what do you do with it so that it's not an additional fire hazard laying there on the ground. So we're trying to figure out, you know, where do you take, how to dispense with the boles of the trees as well as the branches that are left so we don't have an additional fire hazard. So it's going to be a challenge this summer, and we're poised to bring in additional tree fallers if we need to.
And finally, you're deliberative, patience in the face of controversy and adversity, your long service and obvious knowledge of the forest and the Forest Service would put you in line to do any number of things in the latter part of your career. Where are you going with all of this? We want to keep you around here. In fact, you are. You probably know your nickname is Saint Teresa, among many of the people in the collaborative. So where are you headed? What is your aspiration?
Well, I don't know exactly. I think right now I'm happy to stay here and work with the local folks, and sometime in the next few years, probably looking at retirement. I want to figure out where my kids are going to land and follow them there to, you know, bug them, I guess. I don't know. But I'm here for a while.
Well, that's good to hear, and good news for all the people who care about the forest and its well-being in this region. Thank you so much for spending time with us today. I think we haven't covered half of the stuff we'd want to talk about, but you'll be invited back shortly, I'm sure. And Mary, a few announcements, I believe, for the public.
All right. Thank you, Teresa. That was great. And just a couple events coming up this week. Saturday, March 26th, is the annual Spring Fest in Copperopolis at the town square. So if you have any interest in getting outside and enjoying some live music and whatnot. And then a push for the Sierra Nevada Film Festival that's being hosted by Ebbets Pass Forest Watch this weekend at the Black Bart Playhouse in Murphy's. It's $10 at the door, $8 online, and students get even more of a discount. So get out to that. It's 5 p.m. to 10:30. And coming up, we'll have more announcements about this next week, but the Blue Mountain Coalition for Youth and Families will be doing a mask-making workshop as well as other events coming up. So thank you so much to Teresa McClung, and check back next Monday for more on forest fires and community.